This is Mae Bressel. This is tape number 346, August 18th, 1978. Side one. Make mention last week on the tape about the death of Pope Paul VI. He passed away on Sunday, August the 6th, 1978. I suppose the reason I didn't mention his death at that time was that I wanted to cool down a little. I get very angry at these glowing obituaries and the portrayal of him in the news as a great liberal or being almost too liberal, and they describe the Pope as being the most traveled of all the popes. But what the obituaries never say, or they never say when he's alive, is that this, I think, is the only pope, at least that's been exposed, as being in the OSS, which is the forerunner of the CIA. And I don't want any Catholic people to be antagonized, but they might read Bruce Roberts' Gemstone Files to read about the drug traffic in Southeast Asia and allegations of the Pope being familiar with many of the people that were behind the Vietnamese War and also in the narcotics traffic. Also, it's too bad that he didn't live long enough to face a book that it was supposed to come out in June of 1977. Now, that's a year ago. The book might be suppressed. But there's a book that was supposed to come out in England called Treason for My Daily Bread. As I say, it's a year now that we learned about the book, by Mikhail Lebedev. I mentioned him, Lebedev. And he was a Russian Nazi agent who helped Martin Bormann escape from Germany when he was sent down to South America after Hitler's regime collapsed. According to much of the printed literature, and I think it's even been confirmed by a lot of people who have studied the Nazi exodus from Europe, that it was this Pope who helped Martin Bormann specifically to leave Germany and into Italy and then travel to South America. And many of the very top Nazis took that route from Italy to Spain and then South America. This book that is coming out goes into the fact that the Nazis and Martin Bormann were behind the killing of John Kennedy, that they had a large part in the killing of John Kennedy. And a description of the book said their route, in case old intelligence hands are interested, was from Flensburg, Celle, to Brunswick, to Erlangen-Dragenz. I'll write this out for you so you have the route. In Austria, and then they were disguised as monks. The two men were disguised as monks, and Martin Bormann went out as a monk. And they hid in an Italian monastery until November 1945, and then Bormann went on out of the country down to Paraguay, and it suggests that Nazis were behind the Kennedy assassination, had a role in it. And, of course, this has been one of my allegations for a long time. Mr. Lebedev, according to this book review, it was in The Guardian, said a right-wing conspiracy existed to assassinate President Kennedy and that an English gun had been used, a hired gun, and when John Kennedy was murdered. And, of course, Oswald was the decoy, the dupe, and that it was actually a .45 bullet that killed John Kennedy, and that these agents had been set up by Martin Bormann. And, of course, it was the Pope who helped Martin Bormann escape. So I don't take much credence to these long obituaries that I read in the newspaper, but I like to read as much of history as I can while a person is living, not to defame them when they're dead, but just keep track of what they were doing while they were alive. I have two apologies here, and then we'll get right into the SLA story. One is that my tape cassette is not fixed yet, so you'll have to bear with me. With this one, it isn't the best quality, and neither is the other one. The equipment isn't as good as being at KLRB, and maybe I'll have to go back there and tape the shows if the machines break down here. But bear with me, and you'll get the message. And the other is, if you hear a panting around on these tapes and coughing, I have a 12-year-old Cocker Spaniel who has a heart murmur, and he doesn't leave my side, and I don't mind, really, except when I'm making the tapes. And he's right under my feet wherever I go, and he seems to want attention. He isn't feeling too well, so he's panting and puffing. And if I put him in another room, he just scratches the doors and cries. So except for these times, just bear with me, because if you hear something in the background, that's honey in his old age, and I think he's asking for some attention, undivided attention, which he doesn't get. So that's not me. That's honey right here at my feet. It's something I have to live with, I suppose. Talk about Patty Hearst, because her name's in the news right now a lot. It has been right along, but the trial's coming up of Emily William Harris being charged with Patty's kidnapping, and it's only been 4 years since she was kidnapped, 1974. This has been a long wait to try Emily William Harris. And, of course, I wrote in my article in 1974, Why Was Patricia Hearst Kidnapped, that I was told by Alex Bodist of the Drug Enforcement Agency, and when he worked in Indiana, that Angela Atwood and her husband, Gary Atwood, and William and Emily Harris were agents, narcotic agents, on the campus in Bloomington, Indiana, before they came out to infiltrate the prison system and work for the FBI counterintelligence program. And when you're in prison and you're locked up, the word goes out if you testify against another person in prison, you're a snitch. And that could be the trigger to kill Patty and thereby letting the Harrises out. And it's very important to know that not only is she in a prison in Pleasanton, California, where she has to testify against the Harrises while she is in prison, but that Sandra Good and Squeaky Fromm were placed in the same prison. Now, you have a bomb here, a potential bomb from another area besides her being a snitch. Is it Sandra Good and Squeaky Fromm are linked to the intelligence community, and Charles Manson still directs these women? Manson was put into security last week, or 2 weeks ago, in Vacaville because he had some kind of a temper tantrum that he couldn't contact Squeaky and Sandra. And all he has to do, Charlie, is to give the orders, you know, to kill her. And they will. These Nazi types take orders. They're brain-controlled. And another danger here, a bombshell, is that Squeaky Fromm was down the federal prison in San Diego, federal prisons because she threatened to kill the President of the United States, of course, Gerald Ford. And then she was sent to back east to Virginia to another prison with Sarah Jane Moore, who worked for Randolph Hearst during the People in Need program, who admittedly was an FBI agent during that whole period. And Sarah Jane Moore, who was charged with attempt to kill President Ford, also took responsibility for the death of Popeye Jackson, the head of the United Prisoners Union. And there's a whole can of worms of FBI, IRS, DEA agents that can still serve in order to get out of prison or be given leniency. They can do a crime. I've gotten letters from men and met them who were offered a chance to escape from Soledad if they would kill somebody on the outside or kill somebody on the inside. And a lot of my awareness on the prison systems comes from being on the radio for 7 years and KLRB and the tapes in other cities reached to Folsom and Soledad, Tracy, and Vacaville. And that's where I got a lot of information on the prison systems and Donald DeFries and Colston Westbrook and so forth when I first wrote my article in 1974. Now, those of you who don't have my article, The SLA is the CIA, can write to me. I still have a few copies left, and then I hope someday that I can get it into a book with the follow-up since I wrote the article, making my allegations on one section and then following it up with what happened 4 or 6 years later, the questions that were never answered. And I've been rereading this article. I sent several copies to the Hearst family. I've been doing it for 4 years and never got an answer. And finally, Reverend Dumke, Patty's priest, called me, and I have been in touch with him telephonically in the last 3 weeks, and I will be seeing Patty in September. Hopefully, they're arranging a meeting. And there was a woman in prison that said to her, you should meet this woman in Carmel, Mae Brussel, and she told Reverend Dumke, and he told her that he was in touch with me. And I think we can help Patty, but the big thing is to keep her alive. You see, there's techniques when you get into the prison, and I will give you some of the suggestions I gave for her and gave to him, and in the event that she is killed, we'll have these as a record to watch the trial. Before I do that, I just want to read the introduction with you one more time for those of you who have or don't have my article, The SLA is the CIA, because I wrote this, as I say, in the summer of 74. It was 4 years ago. And I made this statement that the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst was vital to the creation of the SLA Army, which, of course, I transcribe as CIA. It was as important as the murder of Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand was to the beginning of World War I. Both the kidnapping, her kidnapping, and his murder were used as an excuse to declare war. The ensuing battles had been carefully prepared and anticipated by the merchants of death, meaning the armaments manufacturers, the police, the FBI, the army, everybody that was to gain from this signal. The end goals of the SLA are World War III, that is the CIA, to plunge the third world masses into starvation and slavery. We have accomplished this through the CIA in 77 countries. The third world inside the United States is the next selected victim, meaning the Chicanos, the blacks, the women's movement even, the leftist organizations, all radical organizations, and by infiltrating them and sending up, identifying their leaders at the time of the People in Need program and so forth, they were easily identifiable and who was working for them, and I even suggested that food could be put into the baskets that had poison in it, such as Dildrin in the chickens that were handed out in that $2 million food program. And I've read recently that there's a high incidence of cancer in blacks in the Northern Bay Area, which I think is interesting, and we have to watch that years from now and see how those statistics come out. The purpose also was to discredit the people at Berkeley. The radical movements were discredited, and then they could be associated with kidnapping and terror and murder and bank robberies and so forth. And I suggested very strongly in this article that this operation of the SLA was a continuation of what we got a glimpse of at the time of the Watergate affair 2 years later that is still being exposed, of how the CIA and the FBI and the Pentagon work and rig elections and affect our lives, including the district attorneys, the Justice Department, the attorney generals, on down. These operations, the SLA and the kidnapping operations that would escalate after Patty and from the time that Patty was kidnapped, were part of the FBI counterintelligence program and the CIA Tom Charles Houston plan combined with the Pentagon, and, as I say, infiltrating all the way down to the local police levels to create the police SWAT teams that are used and will be used during food riots and unemployment. There are unemployment riots stirring up now down in New Orleans, where large amounts of Vietnamese have been brought in and where you have an 80% unemployment of black youth, something like that, and no houses, no low-cost homes, no jobs. And the Vietnamese are getting the choice positions in the town that is mostly a tourist town. So you see it in this area at the airports, at airport stores, at restaurants, with the baggage, and all over where blacks used to be employed, the Vietnamese have been moved in. And then this is going to create a volatile situation. The Vietnamese were part of the CIA Phoenix program in Southeast Asia. And so they're coming in to move out the Chicanos and the blacks, which will provide a natural restlessness with no homes and no jobs and no money for food, and the SWAT teams will be ready. And this is an important thing to watch, because I believe it's not coincidentally happening, but was planned in long stages over a long period of time. Well, I got a letter from the committee in San Mateo to help Patty. July 19th, one of the women had heard me on KGO, and I wrote back and said, well, of course, I will try to help release of Patty Hearst. And they sent me literature from Westchester, Illinois, and I'll give you these addresses and give you a copy of the petition enclosed so that you can write letters. But the favors that I would want from Jimmy Carter are more than just clemency for Patty Hearst. This should actually be a full-scale investigation of the entire SLA affair, even the creation of the double of Donald DeFries, that book, The Black Abductor, that I'll go into more if we have time, the decapitation and the cutting off of fingerprints of Donald DeFries when the body was sent to Ohio, the lies about the autopsy reports and where the bodies were and about their identification, the documents found on the floor of the house when it was burned down, the travel of the SLA members to Europe and the possible links of them to international, the CIA abroad, and meeting there to make their plans for actions that took care here. I think that this is a scandalous affair that's gone on for 4 years, and here is Patty with her life in danger sitting in that jail to testify against the Harrises. Not only will I help them, but I pulled out of my files a registered letter. It was certified September the 4th, 1975, and sent to Randolph Hearst, in which I sent my third copy of The Realist, I guess. They never acknowledged that I was alive up to that point. And this was just 3 weeks prior to Patty's being brought in, or so-called arrested, in San Francisco area. And I wrote to him, and also on radio programs I had said that Patty Hearst would be brought home within 3 weeks, that the CIA, FBI will have to stop the charade for several reasons. And one of the two reasons, the main reasons, was that Wayne Lewis, an agent who had infiltrated the SLA for the FBI and was an agent of the FBI, surfaced publicly and had press conferences identical to the way Lewis Tackwood broke the story of Watergate and wrote a book, The Glass House Tapes. And Wayne Lewis came out the end of August in 1975 and alleged that Patrick Gray's nephew, Donald Gray, was the man who killed Donald DeFries and the others at close range behind the house at the time of the shootout. Now, Patrick Gray is a man who's just been indicted by the Justice Department for his FBI COINTEL operations in the East. He was the acting director. He hadn't been confirmed at the time that Watergate came. He was put in May after J. Edgar Hoover died, and I believe the next day or so, George Wallace was shot. Watergate came in June, and I accused him of covering up various murders in California and riots, counterintelligence out here of Ruben Salazar's murder and Jerry Lee Amey's murder and the riots at Isla Vista. Patrick Gray was instrumental in covering those up and covering up the ITT expose in the Justice Department. He was in the Justice Department when these took place. So I knew he couldn't investigate the Watergate. And then Wayne Lewis came out with the allegations that, and this was after I had written my article. I wrote the article in 74 saying that Nancy Ling Perry and Angela and Donald DeFries had been shot at close range, that they were not, Angela Atwood it was, were shot purposely. They weren't left to flee the house. They couldn't flee. They had to be killed. They were agents. And I said that the bullets hit them at close range. And a year after I wrote that article, in 1975, Wayne Lewis identified the man who he said did the shooting from the back of the house while all the photographs were at the front where the firing took place of that house down in Los Angeles where six were murdered. And he said the man who actually did the close-up shooting was Donald Gray, the nephew of Patrick Gray. And right now he's a teacher at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. Now this is terribly important. If a professor of the FBI, training the FBI from all over the United States, is the man who shot these people from the back of the house without allowing them to have a trial or to speak for what they were doing. This is a very serious charge. And Wayne Lewis said that the FBI had contacted him 2 weeks before Donald DeFries died and said that they were going to kill Donald DeFries and that he was to take his place as the new leader of the SLA. And when he talked about this replacement, it reminded me that in 1974, in April, I had an article that I wrote with Stephanie Caruana, who was at the house here. We gave it to Rolling Stones, and we said it has to be printed right away. The article I wrote was, Donald DeFries the first black Lee Harvey Oswald, saying that he worked with the police, the FBI, and the CIA, and that they would kill him, set him up as the patsy or the leader, and kill him. And the Rolling Stones said they couldn't promise to get it out within a few months. They didn't see any urgency. So we took it to the Berkeley Barb, and luckily they printed it. And 3 weeks before the shootout in Los Angeles, where all six were killed, my article was printed. It's a large four-page article, and I have some copies here, but just three or four, so I can't send them out. And they're full sheets. They're hard to duplicate. I'll have to get it reprinted and get you the article, is Donald DeFries the first black Lee Harvey Oswald, because I had those out and was saying that they were getting ready to kill him. And then a year later in 1975, Wayne Lewis, working for the FBI, said that, I guess this was a week after my article was out, he had been hired to replace Donald DeFries as the new leader of the SLA, which of course he didn't do, and he surfaced and told how that the FBI was in constant contact with them all the time and knew where they were. Another reason I knew Patricia Hearst would be turned in at that time was that J.J. Arms, that famous investigator from Texas, an article in the Time, it was in Time magazine, and he said that he had been offered $500,000 by a large magazine chain to find Patricia Hearst, and he said in quotes, "I'm waiting for clearance from my attorneys to make sure I won't be obstructing justice." Arm said, "If I get the green light, I'll find her in 2 or 3 weeks or less. I don't mess around." So as soon as I read that, I knew that Patty Hearst would be in within 3 weeks, because if it was a CIA operation, no private magazine, I don't know who it was, whether it was National Enquirer or who it was that was putting up this money for Arms to find her, but he knew where she was, and he would know where to get her. And if all of these people, Emily William Harris and Patty, were in the hands of private people, then the control of Patty couldn't continue, and the trial wouldn't have gone the way it did. Because as soon as she was arrested, she was put in a cell, and the cell was bugged, and that was used in the trial against her. And the framing of Patty Hearst, the continuous framing of Patty Hearst, wouldn't have continued. And it would be important for J.J. Arms to keep his hands off of her, and therefore they had to bring her in. And after I made those allegations, and on the air on, I think, WBAI in New York and some different radio stations, Patty was brought in, and when she was brought in, Charlie Bates of the FBI, who was trained in England in counterintelligence, he was in Chicago in the FBI in charge of the Fred Hampton, Mark Clark murder down there of the Black Panthers. He went to Washington to be in charge of the investigation of Watergate, but he had to be moved into San Francisco area by 1972, even though Watergate was pretty well covered up by Charlie Bates, because it took 2 years to plan the creation of the SLA by the Tom Charles Houston plan, the COINTELPRO operation, and Bates had to be firmly entrenched into the Bay Area. James McCord wrote in his book, A Piece of Tape, that several days after the arrest at Watergate, about 4 days after the arrest at Watergate, John Dean asked L. Patrick Gray, the acting director of the FBI, who was in charge of investigating the Watergate investigation, and Charlie, the answer Patrick gave was Charlie Bates, of course. And I had that on the cover of my article. He said the same, I said the same FBI official who was in charge of kidnapping Patty Hearst. Patty had an interview, a long article that was done in series in some papers and as a whole in others by Bob Green about her feelings about being in jail at the present time. She's asking for a new trial. She didn't like F. Lee Bailey. But, of course, the reasons they're asking for it are really the wrong reasons, as far as I can see. She says, in quotes, F. Lee Bailey was ineffective. But the truth is, when I wrote the SLA as the CIA, I really meant it was the CIA. And if and when it is, you only get a CIA lawyer to handle the information. And Bailey was very effective in keeping out any possibility of investigating any avenue that I was asking in my articles. And I wasn't even paid $500,000 or whatever the Hearst paid him to defend Patty. I was asking, as an individual woman in Carmel Valley, what in the heck is going on around here? When you have a CIA operation, you don't get a good defense. Percy Forman didn't defend James Earl Ray. He told him to plead guilty. Grant Cooper didn't defend Sirhan Sirhan. He told the jury his client was guilty. Mark Lane didn't represent Lee Harvey Oswald. He went to the Warren Commission and wanted to represent the deceased Oswald. But if you read the testimony that he gave before the Warren Commission, it was the most mealy-mouthed, ineffective, ridiculous suggestion that he would even be able to take the position for Lee Harvey Oswald at that time. And F. Lee Bailey didn't protect Patty Hearst. He was the man that James McCord called first to be his lawyer, and then McCord went over to Bernard Fensterwald, also of the CIA. Leon Jaworski, a CIA lawyer from the Anderson Foundation and the lawyers' organizations, was at Nuremberg. He didn't do a good investigation there. He was on the Warren Commission in a cell with Jack Ruby, representing the state of Texas. He didn't do a very good job there. He went to Watergate and investigated that and didn't get into the Howard Hughes money or Bebe Rebozo or the money that went to Hubert Humphrey or Richard Nixon, the $1 million that was transferred to all of these people, Lyndon Johnson, or the Mary Jo Kopechne story that was part of Watergate, or the shooting of George Wallace. And then Leon Jaworski went on to the CIA Korea story, and he leaves, in quotes, dejected, as if the whole prosecution of this case, the true story, hinges on one Korean testifying, and therefore he goes home and says, well, I quit. CIA lawyers are ineffective because if the operation is CIA, that is their role. And actually, they are geniuses with PR jobs to represent them to be very effective in covering up what they're doing and always coming out looking like they're on top. I think they're geniuses at it. She said that he went to Las Vegas at night and he was drinking a lot and he was shaking and tired. It wasn't the fact that he spilled glass of water down his legs that made him ineffective or that he took pills to sober up that made him ineffective. It was that he went to Las Vegas, the town where all these conspiracies and assassinations have a large piece of the action and the funding from the skimming money. And also Robert Mayhew's headquarters were in Vegas when he was working with agents of organized crime and so forth that were involved in these various assassinations and bringing in these lawyers for these operations. And Las Vegas is where Patty was taken to the home of Mickey and Jack Scott and kept in the Camelot apartments. I always like the overlapping of these names. James Earl Ray was in Portugal in the Dallas bar, and he went to Illinois and stayed with the Paines. Marina Oswald stayed with Ruth and Michael Paine. And when James Earl Ray left the Missouri Penitentiary, he stayed with the Paines in Illinois. And the Camelot motel is the one where Patty stayed with the Scott, the parents of Mickey and Jack Scott. But it wasn't of any interest to Evelyn Bailey to find out how Patty happened to be staying in that town and who she would be staying with, because then again they'd find links to the Central Intelligence Agency. And Walter Scott was in military intelligence. He was the one who blew the whistle, not the FBI, on the Patty Hearst case in Pennsylvania. And then later they said he was suicidal and was going to kill himself, and they put him in a mental hospital because he blew that story and broke the story of where Patty was staying there, and he had been in military intelligence. Patty is sounding pretty okay. She said the only thing good that's happened to her, one of the good things that's happened to her so far, is that she didn't marry Stephen Weed. And of course, I wrote in 1974 that I believed or suggested that Stephen Weed was a part of this conspiracy. Unless we find out who wrote Black Abductor in 1972 in San Diego, this non-existent press and the non-existent author that had the entire script, and I may run down some of that, the parallels between the kidnapping and the book Black Abductor for you. If we don't run that down, then we don't know the role that Stephen Weed played, because it did involve a teacher, and he came out from Princeton and went to a school, a private school where Patty was, and then when she was in college and went to Berkeley, he went over there, and they were together at the time of the kidnapping, and he literally opened the door and said, "Well, take anything you want," and out went Patty, and she didn't see him after that. She didn't see Stephen Weed, and at the time of her trial, he didn't show up. He had a press conference to push and commercialize his own book and hasn't seen her since, and this is a terrible tragedy, how slimy these people are, because no matter what she said about him, she was under captivity at the time. But we just slimed his way out, like the Scotts and the Harrises, and abandoned Patty, and she had no way of knowing that the government had set these creatures up, and I believe they did. Stephen Weed still has a future. We have to watch him and see where he goes from here. Patty said in this interview in the San Francisco Chronicle, July 26th, she said, "Do you know the police had my name as a potential kidnap victim, and the FBI had my name, and they never told my family. They could have warned me, and I could have moved out of my apartment and moved home before it happened, and none of it would have happened. If they would have come to me and just told me my name was on a list, I would have been home in 1 minute. The FBI and Mr. Charlie Bates moved into my parents' home after I was kidnapped, and my parents asked them what would happen, and the FBI said, 'It's okay, we get this all the time. They've probably got her involved in a crime, but when she gets back, we'll put her straight in the hospital.' My parents thought the FBI was trying to help them, and then when I was indicted, my parents threw them out of the house. I still have very bad feelings about the FBI." Now, this is Patty Hearst in 1978, and of course, I wrote that the FBI and the police knew all along. As soon as Joseph Romero and Russell Little were arrested in Oakland, in the Oakland area in 1974, it was in January 74 for the shooting of Dr. Marcus Foster, In the house was the name of Patricia Hearst, and about a van, and suggested kidnapping. And the police went in there and saw all of that and didn't notify the family. And they saw the helmet, the post office helmet that William Harris had, and the identification of all the members of the SLA that were to kidnap Patty, and they didn't contact them. They had 3 weeks to locate these people that were allegedly terrorists and prevent her kidnapping. I'll do more on the other side of this about Patty Hearst and the SLA.